So next Sunday, I'll begin preaching on the various themes that are going to be raised by this year's study. It's the successor to the story, which you'll remember we did a couple of years back. This new program is called Believe. Spread out over 30 weeks over this next year, we'll be looking at three general areas. The first being some of the key things that Christians typically believe. The second part will focus on the practices that distinguish the Christian life. And the third section, which we will be tackling in the fall, is a survey of some of the fruits of Christian belief and life. And it'll help us answer the question, what am I becoming as a result of this faith? This first portion that we're just about to embark upon, what is it that Christians believe, is pretty broad in scope, and it's necessarily so. We have a very simple faith in some ways, and it's also in others endlessly complex. In truth, ours is a faith that will keep you learning for life, because I'm not sure that this side of eternity we will ever get all of our doctrines, our teachings completely figured out. There is much mystery, and there's always more, which is both delightful and at times frustrating, especially for those of us who want to get everything nicely sorted out, like me. So the first section we'll be beginning next week will focus on some of these central beliefs of the Christian faith. And I want you to know that where I am starting today, the teaching I'm going to raise today, is not amongst them. It's not on the list of the top 10. In fact, I'm not sure it's even mentioned until the end of the study, and even then it's only mentioned in passing. And honestly, it's one of the teachings that's given me pause over the years. And I know it's done the same for a number of you too, because you've told me. But I think it may be a good prelude, as it were, a helpfully provocative way to help us move into an exploration of some of the core beliefs in the Christian faith. There's an Anglican priest and church consultant whose name is Lauren Mead. And Lauren has been a considerable influence on many a church leader since the early 1970s. He's a founder of something called the Alban Institute. And his books and his insights on church life have certainly been useful to me. A while back, I realized that Walter Russell Mead, an American foreign policy expert and an academic who I've been reading over the years, was actually Lauren's son. And so that kind of got me interested, and I started following Walter's work a bit more closely. And exactly 1 week ago today, just 2 days after Christmas, I'd gone home from church, and I started doing some reading online in the journal The American Interest, and discovered that Walter had published a distinctly non-foreign policy article entitled, Born of a What? And I was intrigued that here was a purely theological reflection in a foreign policy publication. So I've already linked to this on the church Facebook page, and I will do the same on the church website this afternoon, which you'll be able to, if you go to listen to the sermon again, you'll find this this article published there as well. And I want to encourage you to give it a read if you can. It's worth a few minutes of your time. It's a really good article. You see, what Mead does is he offers some thoughts about the issue of the virgin birth. A not inappropriate way for us to conclude this season of Christmas together. For this is indeed our last Sunday of Christmas. But to summarize the piece a bit, he begins by noting that the notion of the virgin birth is, interestingly, one of the theological points on which most Christians and most Muslims agree. Oh, I didn't know that. It's not impossible that there are actually more people in the world who believe that Jesus was born of a virgin than people who actually believe in evolution. So I think that this teaching deserves at least a little exploration. Something I've not done here before, so here goes. Now, to state the obvious, the virgin birth's a strange and seemingly problematic teaching because, well, virgin births aren't exactly commonplace, are they? And especially not in Qualicum Beach. In fact, any births in Qualicum Beach are notable, but for somewhat different reasons. As a result of this intellectually and experientially challenging biblical claim, many of us more sophisticated folk have been drawn to try and explain it away. For example, the understanding of Jesus' birth to Mary, claiming that she was a virgin, is sometimes dismissed as simply being a reflection of the ignorance of the facts of life in biblical times. What did those poor, ignorant first century folk really know? Well, they surely knew that babies were a product of sex just the same way we know it today. They might not have understood quantum field theory, something about which I have not the foggiest notion either, I might add, or known about molecules, or understood gravity, or discovered bacteria, or the importance of the Kardashians. Again, I'm not strong on this last one either, but it seems to be important. But they certainly understood the mechanics of reproduction. In fact, I would go so far as to say they probably had greater clarity on reproduction earlier on than our children do today. Because back then, houses were small. They knew that sex made babies. There was none of this stork and cabbage patch stuff. And yet, as we can see in the references in both Luke and Matthew's Gospels, this was a belief and a teaching from the very earliest days of the church. Certainly, it was taught in the second half of the first century and perhaps earlier. This wild claim was made quite quickly. And shocking no one here, there were also some people who started dismissing the notion quite early on. And every once in a while, people rediscover this issue and we natter about it some more. Sometimes the conversation then morphs into a rather bizarre sex is sinful debate. And just for the record, the Christian church has long held that sex is actually a created good. We're just a bit discerning about its application. Or occasionally conspiracy theories are raised on how the church was trying to cover up Mary's infidelity, which, when you stop to think about it, is really strange logic. The issue of Mary's virginity was raised by whom? By the church. It's in the Gospels, which makes for a kind of odd cover-up, don't you think? If it was something that we were trying to explain away, then why would we bring it up in the first place? I mean, it's not like Mary was this high-profile person around the Mediterranean who everyone knew. She was a nobody. She was not gracing the cover of People magazine back then. As Walter Mead Riley observes in his article, and I quote, "If sweeping up inconvenient facts about Jesus' birth was the goal, the story about a virgin birth was the worst method ever. It's like a student saying that her term paper is late because she was swallowed by a whale for 3 days and couldn't get wireless reception from her laptop from inside its belly." It's a self-defeating action if the point's about playing the issue down. Now, as I've just mentioned, and I know I've said it here before, I've struggled with this issue a bit. But some years ago, I decided that if I'm going to believe that God made the universe, then tripping over the virgin birth seems to be just a touch inconsistent, don't you think? That God can make the universe? God does lots of stuff that I don't understand and will never understand. So I just need to get over myself and deal with it. That's the way I come at this. So your mileage, it may vary. You can figure out where you stand on this. As I said, I'm fairly sure that this is not one of those issues that's critical to salvation. But I will say this, that the teaching of the virgin birth does actually point to something rather powerful for those of us who choose to believe it. So let me explain. As I said, sometimes these discussions end up pointing to our discomfort with the issue of human sexuality. And that's rather ironic, because this story isn't actually about removing sexuality from the equation. Just the opposite. It's about including God into human life. It's about breaking down the separation between God and humanity. As Mead rightly notes, this story is really about Jesus more than it is about Mary and prudish worries about her virtue. The claim of the virgin birth is really a statement about how this baby was not like any other baby. This baby was matchlessly connected to God. And you'll remember the story from last week's gospel, where the 12-year-old Jesus ends up in the temple saying rather pointedly that this is his father's house. And then we see time after that, that he, while he was just like us, his relationship with God was unique. Which just about brings me to our text for today. Just about. And if you think that the virgin birth is a bit of a stretch, John chapter 1 is really going to push your buttons. But just before we get there, let's get clear about something else about Jesus. Yes, Jesus was a brilliant teacher, but that's not really what's important about him. I mean, if that's all he really is, like, so what? If that's all Jesus is, just a brilliant teacher, then we would probably be wiser just to go home. Because there's lots of great teachers, lots of excellent teachers. Moses stands out in Judaism, Buddha in Buddhism, Muhammad in Islam. The list of great moral teachers is a long one. So pick one. And I know that we would all probably be better human beings if we paid better attention to a good many of the teachings that those folks offered, never mind Jesus' teachings. I mean, wouldn't it be great if you and I could actually live what Jesus taught on the Sermon on the Mount? I would actually settle for just loving God and loving my neighbor. But as you would have assuredly noticed, we fail. I sure do. We fail, and then we fail, and then, of course, a little later on, we fail. And if you don't believe me that you failed, then ask someone who knows you intimately and truly loves you, and they will eventually tell you that you have failed too. So was Jesus a great teacher? Well, of course he was. I would say he was the greatest teacher in human history. But teaching and wisdom and moral understanding aren't really the problem. If it were only that simple. You see, I know the teaching. I understand a great deal of the teaching. I just can't seem to consistently live the teaching. And nor can you. You see, Jesus' virgin birth was a notice to the world that Jesus was different. He was going to be a great teacher, all right, but he was vastly more than that. It was no longer simply a matter of getting your ethics right, or praying in the correct way, or following a certain set of rules. And those are important things. But those are things that we try to do. And it's telling that we do try to make ourselves the center of the story. It's always about what we do. Now, the point of this is about who Jesus really is and what he would do on the cross and what God would do in the resurrection. So who was this guy? Who is this guy, Jesus? In the strange story of the virgin birth, we're directed to his identity. When the gospel writer John decides to relate the story of Jesus' origin in the first chapter, he chooses to reveal Jesus' identity in a much different way than the other gospel writers. And he makes a claim that is far, far more outrageous than mere virgin birth. You'll remember Wanda read to us in that opening verse, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." And my first thought here is, if that reminds you of Genesis chapter 1, in the beginning when God created the heavens and the earth, if it reminds you of that, then good. Because John wants you to make that connection. Like the creation story, this is about a relationship between God and the world. The biblical scholar N.T. Wright notes this. In Genesis 1, the climax is the creation of humans made in God's image. In John chapter 1, the climax is the arrival of a human being, the Word become flesh. So to be clear, John is saying that Jesus is the Word. So let's try hearing those opening verses again in a way that can give us maybe a better grasp of what he's trying to say to us. In the beginning was Jesus Christ. And Jesus was with God, and Jesus was God. Jesus Christ was in the beginning with God. All things came into existence through him, that's Jesus. And without him, not one thing came into being. Life was in him, and this life was the light of the human race. The light, and this is Christ we're talking about here, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. Did not overcome Jesus. This passage is claiming that Jesus, the Word, has existed with God and with the Spirit since forever. Always. And as I was saying on Christmas Eve, this is the shocking thing. This is the big deal about Christmas. In Jesus, it's God, the creator of the universe and all within it. In Jesus, God is coming to live with us. And if you can get your head around this, you're really doing better than me, because I find it absolutely staggering. I think I've got it, but then I don't. God came to live amongst us. And then Jesus entered into human life, assuredly to teach us, but also to make a way that we might come to God and that we might know God. And that would require a most decisive intervention, something that only God could do, something Christ would choose to do on a hill just outside of Jerusalem. And so we celebrate this Christmas, not so much the mechanics of Jesus' birth, though I would dare say that they are one more thing that reveals his identity, Emmanuel, literally God with us, but we celebrate at Christmas God's most graceful initiative to be with us, and that through the Holy Spirit, God has stayed with us. Jesus Christ. He was a human being just like you and just like me. And yet he was also God. Praise be to God. Amen.